if we could shift from a symptom-based or reactive healthcare to proactive by 2040, and this was a timeline because a lot of these innovations will take time to come around, we would cut $2.2 trillion per year off the healthcare expenditures. Medicare is going to grow 45%, but we'll save $500 billion on Medicare, and it's our only pathway to saving it. To the hospitals, I say, guess what? You're going to win in this. The patients are the number one. The people are going to be the biggest winners.
Welcome to Pemba On Demand, Physician Leaders Making a Difference. I'm Norm Chapin, your host. Pemba On Demand is produced for physicians seeking professional development. We discuss a wide range of topics on the podcast, including successful innovations in a variety of healthcare disciplines, current issues in healthcare career development, and healthcare leadership. I will be interviewing physician leaders from the U.S. and from other countries, most of whom graduated from the Physician Executive MBA program at the University of Tennessee. We hope you will take full advantage of these practical, insightful, and relevant discussions designed to help physician leaders get new and build upon existing leadership skills and perspectives. Pemba On Demand will allow you to be an even bigger force for good in healthcare. Today, I'm excited to bring you episode 55 with Dr. Rob Hedrick. This is a really thoughtful conversation about physician leadership, professional growth, and the opportunities that can emerge when you begin to think differently about your career and your influence. Dr. Hedrick brings a great perspective to this discussion, and I think you'll appreciate both the practical insights and the even bigger picture lessons from his journey. So whether you're leading now, preparing to lead, or exploring what more is possible in your career, this episode is for you. Let's dive in. Here's Dr. Rob Hedrick. Well, Rob, welcome to Pemba On Demand.
It's great to be on with you.
I've been looking forward to our interview for a long time, so I'm glad we're finally getting together.
You know, it seems like Pemba was just yesterday, and the cohesiveness of the group and the cohorts you're part of, you dig enough coal together that it's just, they're great relationships, and who would have thought sitting here talking to you on a podcast about things I'm passionate about, that's success.
Yeah. It's been exciting for me to talk to different alumni from the program and to find out what they've done after Pemba. It's been a fun job for me.
But it is, and the journey's not always longitudinal. It's not always what you think, but it's such an exciting journey of right and left turns that it sets the course of your career off in a direction I don't think anybody, even during the Pemba, you could have imagined where it takes you.
What was the stimulus that led you into Pemba?
Well, there's a couple of factors. One, a fellow thoracic surgeon ahead of me had done it, and I'd always talked about it, and there was the really enticing moment was there was an opportunity in Knoxville, right outside of Chattanooga, to go up and help a cardiac surgeon who was struggling with a lot of shifts in the market. And at first I said no, and then at second I go, well, we don't have kids. We know friends in Knoxville. This is about a year before Pemba. So I sat down with the CEO, and I thought if I structured things where I could ensure safety, I could do something in a different hospital. I brought my whole team, all our instruments. When you're patients prepped and draped, if everything else is controlled, I thought I could reproduce the same quality. And I was really more worried about that. So I had everybody give me their overtime pay, exaggerate that a lot. I was met down with the CEO of the hospital and offered this proposal that I'd do it for 4 months, give them time to hire another cardiac surgeon. We'd commit to 2 days a week of operating. But I wanted travel expenses. I needed a place to live in. Everybody wanted salaries of, I quoted him, I said, I'm going to also keep my professional fees, but I want a guarantee per day. And he reached over the table, shook my hand, and goes, deal. I go, wait a minute, this is where we negotiate. I came with negotiating numbers. And he goes, this is where I tell you that you don't understand the business side of healthcare, and you undersold your value, and you could have gotten a whole lot more. And part of it, he was giving me the profit margin per case of a cardiac surgery case in his hospital. And he goes, I'm looking at zero, and zero is a bad number. He goes, so you just took about 60% of my profits. I still have 40%, and that's way better than zero. He goes, if you've really done your homework, the hospital is actually up for sale. And if I lost the certificate need for cardiac surgery, I would have lost about $100 million off the value of the hospital. You could have asked for anything. So then I tried to re-engage the conversation, negotiate with him. He goes, we shook on it. He goes, you'll do fine. I said, well, I think it's time I need to understand your world a little bit better. And then it was a joking conversation, a great relationship. So the irony of I was scared to jump back into it. I didn't know if I had what it took at my age to do this. And Some of it's the mental acuity, the reading, the studying, and also maintaining a full-time job. My wife changed my pronouns and said I was just chicken and that I really should do it. So I actually talked to Dean Stahl, called him on the phone, and on the spot he goes, "You're ready. You can do this. I'm offering you a position right now." And it was, I had to say yes. And in there started a journey of what I had only equated school and our education to being medical school, to the high rigors, the amount of memory exercises, just the notes I took in a class. And it was a totally different experience. One, we all had jobs there, so we weren't competing for a spot, but it's a different kind of learning. A lot about yourself, leadership, how to take ideas I may have had in my head, but take them to possible fruition, and how to go through that business planning. But it was just a totally different, pleasurable experience. All day in class, 12 hours on campus, I may have ended up with 3 pages of notes. That would have been so overwhelming, but it's a different kind of learning. But probably the biggest change in my life was the confidence I could do it, how much time I was wasting that we all waste in our daily routines. But truly, I think it gave me the preparation I needed to get through this stage of healthcare, which is in a lot of turmoil, but a seat at the table. It gave me the opportunity to know the conversations and to be able to engage in a way that I wouldn't have confidently been able to do. And the relationships I gained from it, I had to say yes, otherwise no way I could hang up and tell my wife I'd turned it down because I was chicken. But it was a lot of factors that came into it. Was the right time at the right moment.
So what are some of the things that you took away from Pemba that you find have had really the strongest residual value for you in your career?
I think the strongest thing I took away was knowing more about myself. My personalities of when somebody doesn't agree with me, what I tend to do and crawl in the corner and maybe become disengaged. How do you motivate people who don't think like you do or act like you do, but you've got to get something accomplished? So the leadership skills are by far the biggest thing. Reading a balance sheet, helpful. Understanding how to do putting a business plan together. I've probably reproduced my same business plan that I did in Pemba, looking at the pro forma, net present value tools that I'd never had, that I've used in multiple different pitches and different startup proposals and innovative ideas to within the hospital itself, of trying to look at programmatic things we're looking at and what's the value, what's their commitment from a capital standpoint, but what's the return on investment, what's the risk if we got on this pathway. Everybody's arguing for a limited budget, but you can come with a lot more preparation and numbers behind it. The first time I did it, I don't think they really trusted my numbers. But with time and success, you then get a confidence of sitting at that table, but also putting a experience behind that business plan that they didn't have to go and check everything that I did.
Well, one of the things we're going to talk about on the show tonight is one of the business plans, I guess we could say, that you're working on right now. And I'm really excited to talk with you about that and to learn a little bit more about that. But I thought maybe you could give us a little bit of background. You're a thoracic surgeon. You specialize in lung cancer. What is the problem that you're focused on right now that you're most determined to solve in lung cancer?
So after Pemba, there were some, actually during Pemba, one of the business plans we did for the Shark Tank type venture that I think our group won was really around operating room innovation and some ideas that I thought were good, but when you laid it out and what was required from me just wasn't the right fit. So we backed away from some of that. But lung cancer, you go back to what your passion is. I've always felt I want to do something in medicine that hadn't been done. My dad was part of that cardiac generation in the 50s and 60s that really took congenital heart disease to a survivable disease with very little tools, but a lot of teamwork and leadership and solving engineering challenges. And I thought, what an amazing career. Before he died, and one of the things that he said is, "Yeah, we did a lot for heart, but we never figured out the lung. I left you something." So in my experience that I left Mayo early 2000s back to Chattanooga, we first had an insight that lung cancer is one of those diseases that we had completely wrong. Always blamed it on tobacco. Turns out one of our biggest growing populations are women non-smokers. There's a genetic link to it. In fact, most smokers won't die of lung cancer, they'll die of a heart attack. My dad in 1995 just knew he's going to die of lung cancer. He started smoking early. In his days, he smoked in the hospital. The patient smoked in the hospital. Things we can't imagine today, but it's part of his world. But he withdrew from healthcare because he knew his death sentence because he smoked. He deserved it. And it was this nihilism or stigma that had been associated with it that he just disengaged from his health. Turns out he died from a heart attack, which is exactly what we know today. Their biggest risk isn't lung cancer, it's a heart attack. Probably about 3 years after that, from the NLS, no, not the NLST, the ILCAP, Claudia Hinschke and David Yankovitz from Mount Sinai in New York had started seeing that lung low-dose CT scans were a screening tool that likely could lead us into a different world with lung cancer. So that knowledge then transformed into the randomized trial, which then said, hey, lung cancer is actually easy to treat. We have to find it before it finds the patients or patients aware of it. And the symptoms that we always use to drive us to healthcare can't be reliable enough and get somebody to the hospital in time. We have to go to them. We have to make screening easy and educate them on this screening tool. So it became the challenge. I said, that's it. It fits in my wheelhouse. We're at such a low point in healthcare. We're 18% 5-year survival. There's nowhere but up we can go, but it'll involve innovation, technology, trying to re-educate the healthcare professionals, as well as a lot of the patients who believe, just as my father did, that there was nothing that can be done. Now, that was a journey that I wasn't sure where it would take me, but was worth putting my time in and what I'd learned at Pemba to try to make a difference in this area.
Now, are you exclusively focused on lung cancer, or are you still doing a combination of lung and cardiac?
So when I went all in probably about 8 years ago, where I truly saw this opportunity, I go, I have to put every resource in it. We didn't need another cardiac surgeon. My partners are good. There were enough people in Chattanooga, but there's really nobody in this space. It was going to take somebody who's willing to be visual, both from a political standpoint of state government, from Washington level to innovation and communicating through whatever media outlet to try to change the perception and also figure out better ways of delivering this kind of care and screening. And it was I think in the early startups I'd looked at in the operating room design was one of the projects we had pushed. When we were looking at the requirements from all the capital venture people were you have to quit what you're doing, you have to be 100% focused on it, or you'll never achieve it, and you won't certainly represent our interest and investment in it. And it really put on me, if I'm going to be successful, I have to just narrow everything down to this one thing. And the one thing was lung cancer. So I stopped the cardiac surgery. My partners thought I was crazy because at the time there wasn't much excitement in the lung cancer world. And then shortly after that, I start building buses and they go, you're really lost your mind. I said, just hang on. It's either going to be a big fail or it's going to be a big enlightenment to an exciting world. And fortunately, it was the latter. But it had to be a full-time commitment. So I took everything off my plate that I was doing that wasn't adding value or didn't. It's just a me too kind of process in healthcare and be that lone nut for a little bit.
Was there a personal aspect to this? You sound so passionate about lung cancer. Was it your father's personal smoking history or some other life experience that you had that really drove you to focus on this?
My father was certainly a big involvement in my life, gave me the confidence to do something. I look back on his journey and what was going through his head of, I did this to myself, and yet he didn't. And when I looked at cleaning out when my mom died, we're cleaning out all the papers they had, he had a failed cardiac stress test shortly before he died. And he chose to do nothing because he just knew he was going to die of lung cancer. One of my uncles who gave me my first beagle, great guy. Was baseball coach in East Tennessee. The outfield, the porches in the outfield of the UT Stadium is actually named after him. He had something when I was a teenager. They didn't know what it was at the time, but this guy who's a big, gruff, ball cap wearing ball coach that everybody loved in this small town of Oakdale, Tennessee, died of lung cancer. And I saw him go through this treatment. He literally became anorexic and just, it was horrible to watch. And I didn't know what it was, but I knew I didn't want that. Now seeing, wait a minute, people don't have to die. We've had a ton wrong about this disease. It should be easy to re-educate physicians and the public and let everybody's going to jump on the screening test. But it was the momentum of both the innovation challenge, doing something in medicine that hadn't been done, that was always intriguing to me, but a challenge of, could we do it? Could we change the perception that you don't have to die from lung cancer? And I think my father and his choices of not engaging in healthcare and dying at age 67, I'm 61, and I think, man, he was young. At the time, I thought he was older, but and my uncle, who was this bigger than life guy, who I said, he let me have the pick of the litter of his beagles. And it was just one of those guys that I could see why his players looked up to him, just being emaciated by disease. And then you start looking at the impact on our state, on the southern states. We have one person dying every 2 hours of lung cancer still today. And I go, okay, this is a problem that needs to be solved, and it's going to take people to think differently, organizing them as a team, a group approach. This is what Pemba kind of taught me. Maybe I'm actually going to get my money's worth and put it all together. And whether you're sitting down with the governor, or whether you're sitting down with other medical centers and trying to get people to start working together, it was the right spot for all the investment I had and my parents had made for my education.
So you mentioned low-dose CAT scanning and the kind of the revolution that it's led to in terms of early diagnosis and the focus on that. Tell us a little bit more. You referred very quickly to the bus, which we've talked about in preparation, but tell us a little bit about what you're doing to enhance the impact of low-dose CAT scanning even further.
So in 2015, we'd gone through all the vetting, randomized trials, and it finally passed the test with the United States Preventive Services Task Force that this is a screening tool that is valuable. The economics around it were good. It got approval, got reimbursement, and we're out of the gates running, and nobody showed up. And even within our own medical center, there was some debate with primary care docs and others about skepticism towards it. And that was sort of the leftover from the generations before of what we knew about lung cancer. So the challenge in the first couple of years was, gosh, is this, did I go down the wrong pathway? Is this not something that people are going to accept? And I kept saying, in 20 seconds, you can get a screening test that'll save your life. And yet we've been able to get people to go through colonoscopies, the prep, mammography, your breasts are squeezed, you're taking your clothes off. It's violating personal space. So surely to goodness, with a different maybe marketing or educational campaign, we can get people to go down and get a CT scan. The challenge, what I really learned, is the messaging problem was nobody knew about it. Even today, 10 years after its original validation and approval by CMS, a lot of people still have no idea about low-dose lung screening. So that was the messaging problem. And then the second piece I learned quickly in the first few years was we had a listing problem. The people were asking to get it were in their 50s. Their life's chaotic. They're busy. They have kids that they're in college or having to manage. They have business. They're likely taking care of their parents, which I was doing in my 50s. And I'm asking them to go stop, take a day off, and go to a traditional hospital and wait for hours in a waiting room and get a scan that really only takes minutes. And it was too big of a hurdle for them to do. There was a fear of the results, but I think the access issue was what I wasn't listening to them. And the messaging problem was we weren't talking and saying it in the right way that people were listening or understanding the value of it. When I got down to how much time would somebody give me for this test, it really is equivalent to the same time you'd wait for a fast food meal at McDonald's, maybe a little bit more at Chick-fil-A or a higher-end fast food restaurant. But it came down to about 7 or 8 minutes. I tried to logistically pull that off within the brick and mortar walls of the institution, and I just could not get it to work at that scale or that speed or understanding what we're asking these patients to do or be that accommodating. So it led to I've got to redesign and find a way that meets those goals. And the bus ended up being that idea.
So when did your first bus start CAT scanning patients? How long have you been doing this?
Two things on the bus. I'll say when I was vetting the idea and talking about it, some were like, "You're crazy. What are you doing?" I had the imaging companies. When I said, "Hey, I want to build a bus that didn't exist. I want to put the CT scan machine on it." They showed me a CT scan with the cover off. I don't know if you've seen it, but there's this gantry that's 3,000 pounds spinning at 8,000 RPMs that is highly sophisticated, temperature and humidity dependent. And if it gets out of balance, will kill a human being in the middle of it. I said, okay, yeah, I'd still want to put that on a bus. Let's figure it out, though. We went to the moon on a calculator. Surely I can figure out this problem. So that became some of the engineering challenges. Part of the messaging piece and what I was really going after, I actually went to a concert in Nashville. I was vetting this idea, and we went on a friend's tour bus. We were a bunch of nobodies and showed up, but we parked where the band's buses were. We stayed on the bus for a while, and everybody's looking and seeing who it is, what's going on. So one of my buddies, I put a coat over his head and we ran out the bus as we were somebody. And the conversations that started, I go, I need that kind of a when I drive up someplace, there are people asking what it is and gives me the permission to then tell them about something in medicine. So the first thing we went and took an old 16 slice CT scanner that was close to its life's end. The imaging company had reinforced some of it, and we came up with what we thought would be a safe. And we designed a check at each place we got to, went through a quick check of the balancing of the machine, and everything was safe to put a human being in it. I went to Forest City, Iowa, and bought the biggest Winnebago you could buy. I said, "Don't put anything in it, though. I just want the walls." And then we drove it to upstate New York near Cooperstown and had a third-party vendor put the CT scanner on it, lead walls, designed it just how you would do a normal imaging center. Drove it back to Tennessee, and it was immediately overweight. By the time you put the fuel on it, all the other stuff packed in there, we had to drive it back to New York, take the cabinets out, some of the handicap stuff, and really just sort of shell it down to where it would meet the chassis limit of what the largest Winnebago could have. Put it on the road, and we had some hard stops at 1 year and 3 year. The first year was it had to cash flow, and people had to adopt it, and then it had to sustain that growth, that it was showing that it was a good idea, but also one that wouldn't require continual infusion of funds. So as much as we did wrong, the design was terrible. You should not use an RV format for this. We went through like 11 air conditioners because they're constantly running to keep the machine in the right humidity environment. You go, but it worked. It actually cash flowed. I used the same business modeling, 5 year pro forma, net present value, internal rate of return, ROI, and used actual dollars that came through in the first year following the downstream revenue and all the mistakes. I go, it still worked. But the design had to be changed. So we went back. Now the imaging company built a CT scanner for this platform. We changed a lot of the throughput going back to, Professor Noonan's class in the book, The Goal, Theory of Constraints, and eliminated it. So I had to have that 7 minute visit. This comes back to the PIMBA value. And we literally walked through and took every design so that you could get somebody in the bus, checked in, scan done, and walking out the second door, which is what we added that the RV didn't have, was an inflow and outflow exit. And we could get down to a 7 minute visit, which we then successfully pulled off. If we have to drive an hour somewhere, we have 6 hours to scan and we got to drive an hour back. I want to get 50 people scanned in that time limit, which is one person every 7 minutes for 6 hours. We've hit that goal many times. So all these things then started validating the growth opportunity of what you could do from it. And as we're now 8 years into it, we have a second bus and we have 51 medical centers who are in the process of getting buses or have it. The Canadian government's doing it in the province of Alberta. There's two bills on the Senate and House floor to grant funding for other programs who want to do this. There's a mini fellowship that came out of it from the Society of Thoracic Surgeons that a thoracic surgeon from the Ochsner Clinic came up, spent a month with us. We wrote the business plan following the same PIMBA format and went back to Ochsner Clinic, and he's been going through the negotiations with the C-suite, presenting that business plan. I said, you need to now enroll in PIMBA and so the weekend course with Dr. Hedrick, do it the right way. But those tools have just been lasting. But so, here we are now with new challenges and new problems that you couldn't foresee until you got past step three or four. But
So do you think that this model of low-dose CT screening is sustainable? Is a sustainable model? It sounds like it's being rolled out in new locations all the time.
so it is. The hardest thing we ran into is the success of it drove more business. So as you're screening someone, you want to try to get ideally 80% of them back in for their annual scan. So trying to coordinate that logistically with human beings became difficult. If they had a nodule or a finding, we wanted to rescan them in 6 months, making sure they got back and got the scan done in 6 months. What I thought people would do was come to the hospital and then get their follow-up imaging and would just offload the bus to the brick and mortar. Once you have somebody who goes for a doctor visit and is back in their car in 7 minutes, they will not go anywhere else. It was a hard sell. In fact, we can't get them to go back anywhere else. They'll wait for the bus to come back. So then you think of two buses or three buses and what the state of Tennessee would need to cover all 95 counties. It becomes a logistical nightmare of personnel involved. We don't have enough innovation of how can you manage that large number of people without human beings talking to human beings. There's text messaging, there's lots of ways we get the reports to them, but when it's time to schedule them again, we have to talk to them about where the bus is going to be, make sure we're fulfilling his obligations, and it requires a large number of people to pull this off. The other avenue we ran into trouble is now I just flooded our radiology department with CT scans. We go out to one site. If I scan 50 people and I dump those scans into the radiology department, we now use Starlink to get them in there as we do the scan. We're also looking at calcium scores with each scan and treating it more as a comprehensive chest CT, but it becomes a lot of work for the radiologist to where it'll tie up one radiologist all day reading it. And their excitement for all these scans isn't that great at the beginning point. They'd rather have the more complex scans to read, but it's flooding. I think we scanned now 12,000 people, and there's a lot of images coming in. That's a lot of work that our efficiencies now are bottleneck and getting the scan read and getting the people back on the bus and then more human beings. And you start seeing amazing first step, the messaging. People where we've been, they know the lung bus. I don't have to teach them about lung screening. In fact, Spring City, one of our communities we first went into, we felt like in 5 years we could change that perception of that population. What was the perception? They've never seen anybody live from lung cancer. Small town in Ray County, it's probably a 40,000 population county in this one city, had one primary care doc, family practitioner who was the coroner, the cook at the school, football games and events. She also did all the pediatrics, adult care, but had no access to technology. So we used her with her ability to have a connection to the population. And one of our metrics was, could we change that population in 5 years? First couple of years, a lot of mistakes in just getting information back and forth, getting the people to sign up, the confidence to do it. But as soon as you start finding those first wins, they become your advocates. So she called me about, it's close to 5 years, maybe the 6 year mark. And she goes, you don't know what you've done. And I said, well, we've done a lot of mistakes and just, you were really our first person to take on this challenge and just let me have it. She goes, no, you've changed the community. I said, what do you mean? She goes, you don't come see me anymore. I said, no, I haven't been there in a few years. She goes, and I don't sign up people anymore. The patients are signing themselves up. And when you come, it's always full. She goes, but bigger than that, she goes, we have a dozen people walking around our county with lung cancer still alive. The perception of that disease and seeing that you can live from it and the people communicating about how easy it is and go get this scan. And it's more than smokers. It's let's check your coronary arteries. It's not just a punishment. So it gave us hope that making healthcare simple, the access is simple, changing how we normally deliver it was definitely a winning demand that people wanted. We have to find creative ways of telling people about healthcare issues that are helpful to them. You can't just go blast it to them. You can't put it on a billboard. They won't read it. We all tune off the commercials and, but it became a way of similar to the concert and driving up the curiosity that came from it. We had a small town in East Tennessee where very beautiful. It's known for the Coy River. There was a hurricane in Florida and a couple from Tampa came up to get out of the hurricane and went to this East Tennessee community, rural mountainous community. And we parked in the little town square. I saw the bus and the wife came and said, what is this? And it created the conversation. She eventually said, you know, I should be on it. I fit the criteria. So she got scanned, had a stage one lung cancer in the right upper lobe, went back and got her husband, drug him there and goes, you need this too. And he got scanned, had the same cancer, the same right upper lobe, same identical stage tumors. They went back to Tampa Moffitt Cancer Center, both had their surgeries, stage one before the other. But the story that generated and the hope that it gave lung cancer patients that it can be simple, it can be painless, you can cure lung cancer, those start resonating. And that was really the messaging solution. We're just now dealing with how do you scale this up? And that's where we got to look at other innovative tools.
So what kind of innovative tools? I mean, those are great stories, Rob. Thank you very much. I mean, I love hearing success stories like that, and all of your dedication and hard work obviously has had a huge impact. So as you think about scaling it up, how do you see that happening? What new innovations are you planning and looking towards?
So I'll say what, not knowing the journey when I left Pemba, what I was thinking about doing, what I was going to do with it, it just happens. You just have to be present and take those same skill sets. So in this bus that my partners laughed at me about, we went and published a paper on our results, presented a meeting, and the Annals of Thoracic Surgery struggled with, should we put it in there or not? And I said, it's more a business paper. And I had to convince them that we should be putting these kinds of papers in our journals. So they did actually end up being the article of the month. They sent it out for press releases. 250 TV stations picked it up. The doctor's radio show, I was on there, and I go, I couldn't get anybody to talk about lung cancer. They want to talk about this dang bus. And the biggest thing was how healthcare could be easy. But it gave me that vehicle. It led to a call from the White House. I got invited to come up with Dr. President Biden and his cancer moonshot program. Made my mom happy that something was being done with all the education dollars they spent on me. But it gave some validation, which then led to also a visit to Mar-a-Lago. And really, the bigger opportunity was a group of leaders across the country who saw that and said, come join our project. And the project was simply, we're trying to solve issues that the government can't solve. They need our help. We're all here not to make money, but to truly offer solutions. And the first thing we came up with is all these scans that we are going to flood radiology with, we got to expedite that efficiency. We need artificial intelligence to start reading the scans and help them out. So they're more checking and validating it's correct, agree with it, but we can now, instead of a scan being read every 8 or 10 minutes, you can do it in 1 minute. And now it's not tying up the resources. If you think of how many people we should be screening in our community, it's 30,000. If I dump 30,000 CT scans on a radiology department, they can't handle it. We're ill-equipped from a human capital standpoint, but just how we're doing things, it will bottleneck the institution. So one, we got some blessing from the radiologists that we don't mind you easing our load. This is a screening test. So the AI software tool, not just to read the lungs and help with this is highly malignant, not likely malignant, looking at all the other opportunistic values on that scan. So really the number one cause of death in America is still a heart attack. Yet we're all looking at the scan with coronary artery disease, and it was our number one finding when we started the program and what we published. It wasn't lung cancer we found. We found 65% had moderate to severe coronary artery disease, and most of them had no idea or were doing nothing about it because there's no symptoms. So it became even, wow, what an opportunity. If we can reduce mortality from lung cancer, number one cause, I mean, from cardiac disease, heart attacks, just by simple early intervention and preventative care, and then look at all the factors on that scan. You pick up diabetes, you look up the inflammatory fat components, the sarcopenia, the fatty liver, all the drivers of poor health and poor cardiac health. And now you can see not just the coronary artery plaque, but the densities in the plaque and the cardiac valves and the chambers all off this low-dose scan. But the radiologists need help with those measurements. And then the value of adding the lung cancer benefits that we know will reduce mortality by a third. Now here's the cheapest, least expensive screening tool that has so much value for our population, but even for the government who trying to fund healthcare at $5 trillion a year right now. So AI software was one tool, and that's what a company I'm a part of, Heart Lung Technologies, we first got through FDA approval for that exact piece of it. And the second piece was we need a different model that is fixed, that you can buy 15 of these as opposed to one bus. Has to be placed in locations where the patient has control, where you can now engage somebody at a much earlier age in life, maybe starting at age 35 or 40. But we had to take the radiation equivalent from that machine down to an extremely low dose to the microsievert level. There's a lot of technology with the photon counting that became possible. And then just changing the whole concept of how a CT scan is done and automating that to where you're cutting out all of the costly pieces of it, but making access even easier and making the touch points or where they can get care even easier. And those are some of the current projects that are being worked on. And what you've soon, you start getting this vision of inexpensive, a comprehensive chest CT scan, preventative health, not reactive health. And then you start seeing how we could financially move the needle of how much healthcare is costing us. On the selfish side, average life expectancy of a white male is 75. My dad died at 67. That's young. 75 is still too young. There's stuff I want to do. And we start seeing a vision. You can live, I think you can live to age 90 with a good quality of health, but you got to keep your muscle mass. You got to keep your bones strong. We've got to certainly focus on the number one and number two cause of death, heart cancer, heart disease, and lung cancer. But we now have the tools that, in the right format and the right way, we give the control to the patient, to the public, not having to get my permission for everything. That's our challenge we're currently working on.
So you've mentioned artificial intelligence. Is this something that is the AI available today? I know that it's used,
Yes.
Pretty heavily in imaging. So do we have the ability right now to really go to a 1 minute interpretation of a low dose CT image?
So what we have that's currently the first step in this journey was all the things a radiologist doesn't want to read or doesn't have time that are valuable in that CT scan, taking that and automating it through an AI software. And so the group I've been a part of, that our goal was to provide that solution, it was Part One Technologies. But in there, it's sort of an addition to a traditional radiologist read. What's the ultimate pathway? And I think the federal government's giving us an opportunity at it to truly first pass autonomous read with a CT scan, with a radiologist overreading a critical finding and validating it. Now I've made his time more valuable. What they're really wanting and what the healthcare systems really want, they don't want 30,000 people coming in for screening exams. They want the people who need to have a hospital, who need a primary care doc, who need that level of management. And so if we're weeding out a lot of that and you can streamline it with an AI-read CT scan with an overread by a radiologist, and I can make the access of a bus or even better, a new type of CT scan that's positioned in retail space, a Walmart, a Family Dollar store, that the cost is low enough that we're not even trying to file insurance. It's either something that a company could give for free or you could use to engage someone in their journey about their knowledge of their body and start with a health coach. Or if they have a significant finding, make sure we're engaging them in the facility or their primary care doc or a pathway to start digging deeper into it. But use the efficiency of the technology and access to get people engaged, but don't flood the hospital systems with a lot of burden that's low level, low benefit, and not necessarily needed to that expertise.
So in your mobile units now, are you able to have that autonomous first read, or is that something that still hasn't been fully approved by CMS or by the payers?
That's what's getting worked on now. And, okay. And the vetting process is the pathway is you first got to demonstrate it can be done. Yep. And that's the design challenge. The second is you got to do it with accuracy and enough confidence and demonstrate that to the government that for FDA approval that you've met these pretty high marks.
Yeah.
But I think people were not willing to even think about that. Looking at the complexities and the volume of lung screening and this opportunity, we got to be efficient. We can't treat it as if somebody who has a nodule is getting a PET scan and we're trying to get high level reads. We're trying to do a screening test. It's got to be inexpensive. It has to have minimal to no radiation. It's got to be at a point anybody can stop by that's not limited on a bus driving and driving back to how do we make that access issue not an issue at whatever location or.
I'm sorry. So are you talking about the actual physical size of the CAT scan unit is something that your team is working on as well?
Yeah, so you start dreaming a different type of scanner. You start dreaming of how can we simplify a machine that we made so complex? It's maybe not needed to be that complex. What we need is the clear image. You need a really low-dose radiation. You need a pathway where somebody can get in and out of it quickly, but it's all automated. If you've ever been in a Waymo car, it has no driver in it. You pull up, you do a handshake with your phone. It opens the doors. You get in. A similar process where someone who at an earlier age wants to start investing in their life, age 35 to 40 is about the midway point. It sounds really young, but really our genetics are starting to play out. And it's the best opportunity to get ahead, particularly of coronary artery disease. But we have to create a system that's safe, reliable, easy, inexpensive. I think our goals of where we're taking this project from the bus to the next step is automating so much of it so that we keep the cost low. And now you're not trying to scan 10 or 20 or 30,000. The population we're now looking for is 40 million, 60 million. They're in that vulnerable age that think they're healthy, but they're really not healthy. My favorite best, and on the bus right now, we're doing that. We just run into efficiency and limitations of scalability. But the concept, if you make healthcare easy, people will do it. You can fix the messaging problem. You can ease their concerns about being proactive or preventative. But my favorite bet is somebody who comes up and starts bragging about how healthy they are. I didn't smoke. I didn't drink. I'm vegan. I exercise. I said, and you look better than I do. You're in great shape. But it doesn't mean you're healthy. And so I will offer to pay the cost of that scan, which is $150. And I said, you're going to do it for the calcium scoring. You don't fit the low dose criteria. So we'll offer a cash pay that they can do the calcium scoring. I've yet to pay for one of those scans. And one of my orthopedic colleagues who was pretty at 58 was very confident how good a shape he was in. Did the scan. It was right by the hospital one day a month. We'll keep it close to my office so people in town can get on it. And he ran down there, ran back. He goes, that was quick. I said, you're back in 10 minutes. And he said, they're not even ready for your next case yet. So I looked at his scan. His calcium score was off the charts in the thousands.
Wow.
He goes, there's no way. And I said, well, it doesn't mean you're going to have a heart attack, but it means we need to start focusing on it. Keep doing everything else you're doing because you look great and you'll be more functional as you age. But we got to address the genetics that are somehow appearing in you. About 3 weeks later, he and his primary care physician decided he probably was more symptomatic than he was leading on. Led to a failed stress test, led to a coronary CTA, which led to a cath, which led to a stent and his LAD that he had a 95% blockage. And he goes, I was sitting there bragging to you how healthy I was, how good my genetics were, and I was about to die or have a heart attack and be left with heart failure. So I think the biggest thing we found is our ability to rely on symptoms for healthcare and think it's going to reduce cost. We're just approaching disease too late. We have amazing technology, but we got to get in front of the diseases, and heart disease and lung cancer have no symptoms. So you have to find a way to engage somebody in a simple test that's safe but informative, not scaring them, but truly educate them on what may be going on that we miss by profiling, miss by judging just family history alone, or you smoked or didn't smoke, turning into something bigger. You got a heart, you can still have a heart attack. If you have lungs, you can get lung cancer. It's that simple. There was a study that Mount Sinai had done this past year where they took everybody who had a heart attack, then went back 48 hours in time and said, now let's apply all of our tools that would predict whether somebody should be on a statin or not. They missed that 60% of the time, 50 to 60%, depending on the tool. They then took those who had the heart attack and said in the 48 hours, how many people had the presentation, that moment of the heart attack was their first symptom or sign or knowledge of coronary artery disease. And it was the same thing. About 50 to 60% had no knowledge until that event occurred. So we're just terrible about relying on symptoms, which is why healthcare is so costly. We get into the game too late. Amazing technology to save somebody's life, but what's better is just preventing that event from ever happening. And that's where we come back to it. Our belief is it'll reduce healthcare costs. Belief is you can engage definitely a younger generation into proactive healthcare, which will save obviously dollars. And I think our goal of, and this is our group's goal, live to 90 with a good quality life. All right, I could deal with that. 75 is just not very attractive to me, but 90 is a lot better.
So we have a very unusual and maybe perverse alignments in the healthcare system today. How do you get healthcare executives who really understand the fee-for-service model better than they understand the population health model or value-based model, whatever you want to call it? How do you get them to understand about value creation that programs like yours create that go beyond the direct revenue equation?
So I think it comes back to skills I learned in Pemba. I've had to go to sit with Governor Lee or Governor of Tennessee. I've had to meet with the legislature. I go to Washington. I'll be back there this month. You've got to start educating the people of you want a solution to healthcare. We know we have to get to preventative healthcare, proactive instead of reactive. Can't rely on symptoms to gauge whether you have something or don't, because our bodies just don't give us that knowledge. And healthcare. To go and engage, if you don't have a primary care doc in our town, to get into one, or think you need something and try to do it on your own, it's just too hard of a barrier without some painful stimuli or some feeling of doom to drive you through that process. But in doing so, Deloitte had looked at a economic model. They had heard some of what we were doing, and basically came out with projections that if we could shift from a symptom-based or reactive healthcare to proactive. By 2040, and this was a timeline because a lot of these innovations will take time to come around, we would cut 2.2 trillion per year off the healthcare expenditures. Medicare is going to grow 45%, but we'll save a half a trillion dollars on Medicare, and it's our only pathway to saving it. To the hospitals, I say, guess what? You're going to win in this. The patients are the number one. The people are going to be the biggest winners. But we're now shifting health. A lot of dollars were I did heart transplants. I put in lots of LVADs. You go into all the amazing technology. It's so expensive. You cut those things out. You cut the immunotherapy drugs out. You start dealing with a disease at a different touch point. That value and that economic shift back to the hospital model, which is what they need to survive. But you're now taking and turning late stage lung cancer into 80% will be early stage. All that treatment's done in a hospital. You're saving the government money, but you're driving revenues back into the hospital, what they do best. And to physicians and primary care, to hospitalists, to pulmonologists, you want patients that are going to stay alive, and you want to have easier challenges and more meaningful outcomes. And it's a win for everybody. It's just, can you pull this off? Can we create that scalable model that gets to comprehensive screening with tools we have today that we didn't have when I finished PIMBA? That I think gives us those vehicles to getting there. We're projecting about a 5-year journey and trying to be able to have a scalable product. Some of the milestones we've met already, but it's, I can't disclose everything about it, but it's an exciting opportunity that the win is well worth the effort.
So if you look 5 years down the road, what in this innovation is successful, what does that look like for lung cancer screening across the U.S. and even the world?
So most of our screening tools, we try to look at cost of the screening per life saved. It's not an overall how much is spent on the treatment, but if I'm going to have a screening test that's reimbursed and all the expenses that come along with it, how much did I spend to save one life? And the value is usually around $100,000. So most of our decisions in Washington about who should get screened for lung cancer is based on still tobacco and age. We're trying to balance that cost versus life saved. If we switch to a low cost, very accessible process, where all we do is on age and start screening everybody at age 40, we'll identify 94% of the lung cancers. Mm-hmm. And that cost per life saved equates to $101,000. So you have a greater opportunity if we can keep the healthcare costs down, we can gauge people in at an earlier age of getting in front of the disease, but doing it in a way that becomes a valued test. But we've got to make sure the radiation dosages, we're working in microsieverts now. That's, for an analogy, a trip from Chattanooga to Atlanta in an airplane is a kind of dosage way less than a chest x-ray, that we can create an image, a CT scan, and be able to still look at the coronary arteries and look at all the data points we need on it with such little radiation. That's the fascinating window on that technology side. Changing the look of a CT scanner, it won't look like what we normally see now. But putting the control into the people's hands where you don't have to have my permission to engage in a test that will help you get healthy, you might just need a health coach. So allowing them the freedom of doing it outside of an insurance system where it's either free or extremely low cost, to then pairing it with a health coach, or if there's a real issue, connecting them into the medical center and physicians where their time is more value appropriate for that scenario. But taking away the barrier of having to call me to get permission to get a scan to see if you're healthy or not. And it's a conceptual change that, again, there's a whole lot of vetting of, is it the right move? Does it really save lives? There's a lot of this that works still to be done, but you're starting to see the light at a different kind of healthcare system and a population that really wants to be proactive.
So when do you see the lung cancer screening guidelines being changed? And will that be because of a result of this technology that you're talking about?
So 5 years, you can petition the United States Preventive Service Task Force to relook at the guidelines with data. So what we're asking them to do now is to make the next change, which is eliminate the time you quit from tobacco to you're getting a scan. If it's more than 15 years, the thought was your risk went down.
Right.
It really doesn't. So we now have data to say, let's remove that piece from it. Mm-hmm. So it'll be 20 years of smoking exposure and an age greater than 50. And we're doing it just because of working within those cost restraints and trying to create a scan that has more radiation. We're in the 2 millisieverts as opposed to microsievert level, that we got to be careful who we're radiating and do things wisely. The jump will come, and this is just going from a Model T to a Tesla. There's a lot of steps in between where we see access being given to the patients without having to have permission, in a reliable way that's much more inexpensive health coach, or here's some proactive things you need to do from your muscle density to your bone health to your heart. to lung health, getting people with a picture, they will engage in their health and be more compliant than just giving them a bunch of LDLs and HDLs and lab on a piece of paper. And then trying to be able to execute it is a logistical challenge in itself. But all the steps of FDA approval, getting something that works, we're looking at a randomized trial with this technology of looking at a low-dose CT scan with the AI tool versus someone who's just doing regular care. And did it save lives? Did it save the money? And there's a lot of work. We've got to prove the concept and that we're not just out there doing body scans for no reason and no methodology or rationale behind it.
So do you have any sense of what the probability is that the USPSTF will modify their recommendations and eliminate the current standard that once you've had 15 years of non-smoking that you don't benefit from the LDCT?
I think it's likely.
Okay.
The data is certainly there. The challenge Washington was never meant to move quick. And so in this, you've got a petition, you've got to put the data in front of them, they'll put it out for review and goes through a process. Then once their approval comes in play, Medicare reacts pretty quickly, but the commercial payers have to get on board. And they actually have, I think, one or two years from when your renewal date was to actually complying with the new codes. And they're given a lot of leeway to not be compliant within that. So each reiteration takes still years to get it to where it's a paid for and a approved standard. And we're making progress, but it's slow progress. But that's Washington. And maybe some of the good of that is you realize you don't want to change things too quickly in a whim. You want to make solid decisions. They're sort of mama bear or daddy with the wallet. They've got to control a unbelievably large, $5 trillion going to $8 trillion in healthcare. They can't print money fast enough. So they're trying to make sure that decisions are truly made with some scientific backing. Mm-hmm. I think what I've learned from being involved is, walking out of the White House, you know, they don't make a product. They need the smarts. They need the PIMBA community. They need the scientists, the innovators, not only to come up with something, but make it make sense, validate it. And that process still takes time, but you'll make more headway in doing that than just waiting on the government to come up with the ideas or to change the legislation or the rules or what CMS is going to pay. There's an inherent slowness on purpose, but too many lives get lost. Tennessee, we got one person dying every 2 hours. Mm-hmm. That's the urgency of helping them solve the problems. There's a great research arm called the ARPA-H in our time. And so it's heavily funded. There's billions of dollars in it for high risk, high failure projects that truly could change healthcare. So you're taking the venture capitalist maybe away from it. You're taking the risk that somebody might have, and the government, you'll pitch to them and go through a process. And if they validate that process as being something that meets those requirements, then they'll invest as they were the venture capital. And you'll have like a phase, you got to hit this benchmark, and they'll reanalyze it. And they may up the contribution. So we've been going through that process to help us with this, where the government's a partner as opposed to a Fortune 500 company or venture capital people that may have different motives than what ours are. It's not wrong if we make money, but the real goal is, can we change healthcare?
Yeah.
And can you do it? And can you help provide the solutions and the data and the validity behind it to truly transform how we view our health, how we look at a proactive tool that's better than guessing, but still safe and responsible? And when I look at where do I go with the rest of my career, man, that's a plateful there. But it has light surrounding it. It has some success in areas where I didn't think it would be successful. And the number of people that are going to be able to jump on this journey, it's going to take a team to pull it off. But I certainly would hope it would excite other PIMBA grads to say, hey, this is something that fits my wheelhouse of healthcare. I want to change the world. Who doesn't want to cure cancer? But just fun things that will take every skill set you learned in that 12 months of pretty intense training, from knowing yourself to business planning to financial modeling to innovating and how do you get through all the legal requirements. I've been fortunate with this to sit on some pretty powerful meetings with fairly large companies. Mm-hmm. I would never have had the confidence of sitting there as a physician with no business knowledge. Now one with just some maybe overconfidence, but some understanding what's going on. It's opened up my world to things I never would have been a part of and had the courage to go through and and pursue.
That's great. Well, Rob, we're just about out of time here. I really appreciate you taking the time and sharing your story with us. The passion, the innovation that you're involved in has been very exciting. Thanks so much for being on the show.
You're welcome. My honor.
Thanks for joining me for episode 55 with Dr. Rob Hedrick. I hope this conversation gave you something to think about in your own journey, whether that's leadership, career strategy, or simply expanding your view of what's possible as a physician. Be sure to subscribe and share this episode with someone in your network. Leave a review if you're enjoying the show. And until next time, keep learning, keep leading, and keep building the career and life you want. Thanks for listening to Pemba On Demand. We release new episodes bi-weekly, every other Thursday. You'll find us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and Castos. Hit follow or subscribe to us and add us to your library. If today helped you, please leave a quick review and share the show with a colleague. Questions or comments? Drop them on our YouTube channel, Pemba On Demand. For episode links and resources, check the show notes and visit tiny.utk.edu/Pemba On Demand, all one word. Take good care and keep becoming a bigger force for good in healthcare.